Hey, everyone. If you like this podcast, you should check out the full finance journey at realvision.com/RVpod to get the full view of what Real Vision is all about. A video on demand platform you can watch anywhere. Our members get daily videos and analysis, plus access to more than 3,000 videos for beginners and experienced investors alike, and live events online. You'll join the most thoughtful community in finance. More than 300,000 people who trust Real Vision to be the anchor to truth in the financial world. To get started, visit realvision.com/RVpod. Use the promo code PODCAST10 to get 10% off our essential membership for your first year. Enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Briefing at Real Vision. I'm Andreas Steno, the Senior Editor at Real Vision, sending to you live from Copenhagen, Denmark, Tuesday, the 2nd of August. We've got a bunch of things to unpack in relation to the situation in Taiwan, as well as the major moves that we've seen in financial markets today. And I have a couple of great guests joining me for the next 30 minutes. Firstly, Taylor Fravel, Professor at Political Science and Director of the Security Studies Program at MIT. Welcome, Taylor. It's very good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
You'll help us unpack the developments in Taiwan in a second, but also a warm welcome back to the show to you, Tony Greer, the founder of TG Macro.
How you doing, Andreas?
Good, Tony. Good to see you. Firstly, Taylor, I wanted to ask you, Nancy Pelosi basically just landed in Taiwan. Was it a few hours ago? Is this part of a bigger strategy orchestrated by the White House, or what's the reason for this visit?
No, I don't think it's part of a bigger strategy by the White House at all. In fact, for weeks, they very quietly, I think, tried to persuade her not to make this trip because they were worried about how China might react and the potential for a crisis across the straits. But nevertheless, she is clearly committed to going. This trip was originally planned for April, but was rescheduled after she came down with COVID. And as the Speaker of the House, I think she's probably long wanted to make a trip to Taiwan. Depending upon how the elections go this coming fall in the United States, she may not be Speaker for much longer. And of course, China has featured prominently in her sort of role in Congress, going all the way back to a trip she made to Beijing in 1991 in support of the student demonstrators and workers in Tiananmen Square. And so she clearly has strong personal reasons, I think, for making this trip. I think she also probably believes that she wants to demonstrate U.S. support for Taiwan. And this would be the opportunity to do so before she steps down as Speaker.
Pelosi has basically defied like a load of Chinese warnings ahead of this visit. Should we expect a major response from China to this visit?
We should, and we're already seeing it in the military domain. Literally within moments of her touching down in Taipei, the Xinhua News Agency issued a quote authoritative release outlining six closure areas in which military exercises, including live fire exercises, would be held from the 4th of August to the 7th of August. There are reports last night that 100 Taiwanese firms were sort of barred from exporting some goods, some agricultural goods, I believe, in particular, from Taiwan to China. And so clearly, China made threats before that there would be consequences. And now I think it's going to carry through on those threats because of the importance that the leadership in Beijing attaches to the issue.
Tony, I also wanted to get your take on the market action in relation to this Taiwan story. What's been on your radar in financial markets today?
You know, I feel like the market, Andreas, is more focused on this this battle royale right now between, you know, the sort of inflation bulls and the recession bears, if that's fair to say. Right now, when I look at the tape, it looks like they are, you know, tearing each other's arms off and beating each other over the head with them. Today, you know, we had the biggest, all the action today was in the bond market, right? There's a two sigma spike higher in yields. You know, really without a corresponding commodity move on the tape, which was kind of interesting to me. It looks like that could have been somewhat of a blow up or exit trade or something like that. But that does sort of speak to the inflationary action and inflationary vibes that we've been getting from the market, right? We just went through a week of CPI and PPI where they were both much higher than expected. We came through a weekend where the media is still really focused on this, you know, recession that the bond market is pricing in and the administration is trying to redefine. None of that matters. The market is, in fact, pricing in somewhat of a recession. And it feels like it may have overshot a little bit on the downside, Andreas, you know, with this yield move higher today. We had a big move higher in break evens at the end of last week. It looks like the market based inflation expectations may have overshot to the downside. What feels like to me like there's still a lot of negative sentiment, though, in the equity market. I feel like everybody on FinTwit is talking about the next shoe to drop. That's not to say that it's not going to drop. It's just to say that I pick up some bearish sentiment from the internet, and that's about it. So today's leadership really isn't anything to get excited about. You know, the S&P started off in the red, rallied into the black, ended up in the red again. The leadership was from, you know, a mixed bag, but mostly from some of the sectors that are down on the year again: cannabis, social media, internet stocks. There were big upside moves in Tilray and Aurora Cannabis and Rig and names like that. You know, the downside was really everything cyclical with an extra focus on home builders. There was a two sigma move lower today in XHB. You know, real big follow through in Pulte Homes after reporting bad news last week. A big reaction to the move higher in rates today. So, Andreas, I really see an ongoing, you know, push and pull battle between the inflationary bulls and recessionary bears, if that's fair to say.
Absolutely, Tony. And I wanted to get back to you, Taylor, in relation to this uncertainty seen in financial markets today. We've seen a big increase in interest rates, which is usually a signal that markets are getting scared of geopolitical risks again. There is this Russian proverb saying that this is China's final warning. Is this one of those cry wolf events again?
I don't think it is. I think from China's standpoint, they've been increasingly concerned about changes in the U.S. one-China policy and policies toward Taiwan in particular. This started sort of the tail end of the Trump administration, but has continued and I think escalated, or their concerns have escalated in the Biden administration. And so starting sort of around late last October, after Biden made two of his gaffes on Taiwan, Chinese sort of senior leaders began talking very explicitly about the United States hollowing out its one China policy. In a phone call in November, Xi Jinping told Biden not to play with fire over Taiwan, something he repeated in their recent call was it last week or the week before last? And so I think China's being driven by real concerns that it sees, and thus a need to sort of restore credibility with the United States regarding its own commitment to pursuing what it calls sort of reunification or the unification of Taiwan with the mainland. And I think there's no foreign policy issue more important for China's leaders than Taiwan in the security area. Certainly foreign economic policy is very important in terms of welfare overall, but in terms of security issues, right, this is it. This is what they care more about than any other foreign policy issue. So I don't believe they're crying wolf. Doesn't mean necessarily that they are on the cusp of invading either or taking a major action, but I think they will. We will see probably over the coming weeks and months a whole series of actions that are just beginning with these military exercises designed to underscore China's resolve with respect to Taiwan.
I think we can bring up a chart showing these military exercises around Taiwan currently compared to March 1996, the third Taiwan Strait crisis. And it seems like this time some of the exercises, they actually overlap with Taiwan's territorial waters. Do you see this as an escalation compared to earlier crisis situations in the Taiwan Strait?
I think these exercises have the potential to be much bigger than those that took place in March of 1996, not just because of the overlap with the territorial waters, but simply because of the way in which these closure areas effectively attack Taiwan from the north, the south, the east, and the west. They also target key Chinese ports in the northern and southern parts of the country, One of them is astride the median line and probably the most likely vector of an amphibious assault. And the one to the east is where China has announced that it will conduct conventional missile tests with the prospect for the first time, right, that Chinese missiles could fly over Taiwan on their way to landing in this sort of identified zone. They could be launched on other sort of vectors that might not take them over Taiwan, but certainly there's this possibility, especially if they're launched from the short range kind of ballistic missile units that are immediately sort of off or on the Chinese coast adjacent to Taiwan. So in that sense, I think the scope and scale are probably much larger. The main difference will be that in 1996, apart from the two missile tests and the small black boxes that you see on the chart, the majority of China's response was to simulate an amphibious assault along basically the Chinese coast. So it was simulating an assault of Taiwan, but all the action was taking place basically right off the coast of China. In this case, right, it's going to be mostly air and sea exercises, and they're going to mostly take place right off the coast of Taiwan. So this is a huge difference in terms of how the exercises are likely to unfold. And again, we have to also remind ourselves that in sort of the 1995 and 1996 crisis, which really went from the summer of 95 through March of 96, there are about three or four major exercises. And the map that we're looking at in this chart was only the most, what was the last one of those series of exercises. And so I think there's great potential here for these exercises to continue, perhaps through the Party Congress, which will be scheduled for some time this fall, especially if China believes that it has not reach some modus vivendi with the United States over one China. And that is probably unlikely given sort of the electoral pressures President Biden and the Democrats are going to feel going into the midterms.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
I wanted to ask you as well whether there are any parallels to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Do you think China will look at the Western willingness to sanction Russia and think twice about these military exercises in Taiwan?
I don't think the potential for sanctions along the scope and scale that have been placed on Russia will deter China from conducting these exercises, so long as it believes it can do so without targeting advertently or inadvertently U.S. or Taiwanese assets in the air. In other words, if they can kind of cap the potential for escalation. I think China, of course, has paid great attention to those sanctions and has been considering how to probably sanction-proof its economy in response. But I don't think it would believe these sort of sanctions along such a broad scale would be implemented in response to exercises versus a kinetic use of force that would be intended to basically seize some or all of Taiwan from the Republic of China. And so in that sense, I don't think the scenarios are quite analogous, but certainly it has to be a factor in the back of the mind of Chinese leaders that were this to escalate, right? There is an economic cost that they could pay. And so I think their approach will be to sort of pursue a Goldilocks strategy whereby they have a very robust sort of display of military force that sort of foreshadows what could happen in the future without crossing that kinetic line, starting a war, and thus facing the potential brunt of sanctions that they might face. Also on sanctions, I would note, we have to at least ask ourselves, would the Europeans be as eager to sanction China as they have been to sanction Russia? And so this would be a conflict happening in a very different geography than the one we're witnessing in Ukraine. And although I mean, the unity of the Western approach to Russia is striking and noteworthy and commendable, it remains to be seen if that same level of unity would be achieved if the crisis were concerning China and Taiwan and the United States.
That's certainly a fair question, Mark. I also wanted to ask you about Joe Biden's policy on tariffs on China. He's publicly debated the possibility of scaling back on some of the tariffs implemented by the Trump administration. Are such policy moves off the table, in your opinion, now?
It probably makes them politically harder to do, even though economically, I think they make a lot of sense, right? Because the purpose was to generate leverage to pursue sort of other changes in the Chinese economy. And but we're 3 years into tariffs, and I don't think there's been a single change, right, in the aspects that were targeted. So in that sense, the tariffs haven't been a great policy tool. It's also probably one of the few tools he could manipulate to lower inflation. Economists and folks like you guys probably have a better sense of what that actual impact would be. But it is at least a policy tool that he can pull, or a lever, policy lever he can pull to do something about inflation. And so I think there are good reasons to reduce the tariffs, because they've been either counterproductive or have contributed to inflation. But politically, I think it would be seen now, right, as caving to China in some way, or rewarding China for its belligerence across the strait. And so therefore, it's probably off the table, at least until after the midterms.
I wanted to allow for a final question from the audience to you, Taylor, before you leave the discussion. And it's from Ralph asking you, what have China and Taiwan learned from the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
I think Taiwan has probably learned that sort of the very impressive lesson of sort of the will of the Ukrainians to survive, right, and to fight for the survival of their country. Ukraine is it's not as weak relative to Russia as Taiwan is to China, but nevertheless, this sort of will to fight, I think, is remarkable in Ukraine. Defied the expectations of many analysts before it occurred, who thought that Ukraine would collapse pretty quickly. And quite the opposite has occurred, right? And so I think there's great potential for Taiwan, looking at the lessons of Ukraine, to do much more to defend itself, to defend itself quite robustly with sort of mobile anti-ship and anti-air systems, which would really frustrate China's military operations, especially in a very large amphibious assault. I think from China's standpoint, there are lots of questions. I think effectively, though, they would ask just how ready the PLA really is, right? Has corruption really been rooted out as much as they have tried to do so? Because one lesson we're learning from sort of Russian operations in Ukraine is sort of the continued depths of corruption in that military and the consequences it has for military effectiveness. I think they would also be asking whether or not the reforms they put in place in 2015 have created the nimble kind of force that is really able to conduct high-intensity joint operations. I think it's important to bear in mind that what Russia has tried to do in Ukraine, in sort of the scope of modern military operations, is really the most straightforward, right? Surging forces across the land border, primarily conducting combined operations within your ground forces, not joint operations combining air, sea, and ground forces. What China would want to do across the strait would be orders of magnitude more complicated. And so seeing the Russians face this challenge in conducting relatively simple operations, even though they've adapted to some degree, I think would probably be a pretty bracing lesson for China to think about with respect to the capability of the PLA, which despite 2 decades of massive recapitalization in terms of new platforms such as stealth fighters and surface combatants and so forth, the open question is just how well can that equipment operate it and to what effect. And so I think that will probably induce some caution and contribute to the maintenance of deterrence across the strait.
Taylor Fravel, professor of political science and director of the Security Studies Program at MIT, thanks so much for joining the daily briefing today.
Thanks so much for having me. A pleasure to be with you.
Tony, back to you and the discussion on financial markets. It's been a crazy day. We've seen this massive move in interest rates. What do you make of this move in interest rates and the spillovers potentially to the commodity space and the equity space in the days ahead?
Yeah, I feel like that, you know, there it's really hard to break down right now, Andreas. There's not a lot of correlation in the tape. Things are kind of flying off in their own direction. It feels like the bond market is still reacting to the CPI and PPI data at some level, or at least the fact that the bond market likely overshot the recession on the downside and then got this upside surprise in the inflation data and is now adjusting. It's also adjusting at a very precarious time for the crude oil market. That's like front and center for me right now because, you know, crude oil is testing 200-day moving average, which is a big deal for us technicians. You know, on the bull side, we've still got a lot to hang our hat on. You know, gas buddy says that local gasoline demand is literally at record levels through 9.5 million barrels of gasoline a day, well above historic averages. We've got, you know, still firmly backwardated markets, but we've got them much looser than they were, say, a month and a half ago. So what we've got is the sort of crack spread backing off from the mid 50s to 38. We've got SEPT-OCT diesel fuel backing off from $10 to $4. While $4 is still massively backwardated, it has now been cut in half since its widest prices. So naturally, you see pricing backing off. We see the gasoline market testing the 200-day moving average for the first time this year, I believe. So, you know, the market, the oil markets are respecting the fact that the financial markets are pricing in that recession. It looks like they may have priced them in a little bit too far. It looks like the equity market is still sort of treading water around here, but, you know, more likely downside maybe to come. It could be a situation where we have one of those ripping bear market rallies. If commodities can get on their feet here with this move higher in yields, but it's really tricky right now, Andreas. There's a lot of, it feels like there's a lot of risk coming out in the wash and the markets aren't really going very far. So it's really hard to get a read on.
Yeah, definitely, Tony. I wanted to bring in the tweet of the day from the commodities expert, Javier Blas. He refers to German electricity prices reaching 1,000% of usual levels. And I read a German study today that concluded that a rise of the electricity price of 1,000% will only shave off 3% of the overall electricity demand. So it basically shows that the demand for energy is super inelastic. And that's a point you've made before on this show as well, Tony, in relation to gasoline and oil. What's your take on energy prices into a potential recession, given the information that we got from Javier earlier today?
Thank you very much for noticing that, Andreas. You know, it feels like, you know, we are, whether we like it or not, the markets are telegraphing a bit of stagflation, right? It's impossible to get away from. You know, oil prices have sort of remained, you know, in the upper end of their rally range, at least, while base metal prices have collapsed. Lumber has collapsed, you know, so some of that more cyclical stuff backed way off. And, you know, as we've been saying about that pricing elasticity, it hasn't happened in the oil markets yet. They remain backwardated. They remain tight. You know, we're getting news like we just got out of Marathon Petroleum, right? The biggest American refiner. They made more money in the second quarter than they did in any other year as a refiner, right? Their quarter was up. They reported a $10.61 quarter versus $7.71 estimates and versus year over year comps of 67 cents a share, right? So year over year comps, their P&L is up about 1500%. The stock is up 4% today, recovering all the major moving averages. So there's plenty of things going on to hang your hat on in this market. If you listen to the CEO, he said that diesel demand has softened due to less trucking volumes. And I feel that that's what that sort of diesel spread indicates, where it's backed off its highs. But he also said that tight fuel supplies and strong demand are absolutely going to continue, right? So he offers a very neutral, you know, statement about the oil market, one for each bull, one for a bear. And, you know, you're going to have to decide for yourself here. So I think that as long, though, generally as this tightness does persist, as long as we see indicators like, for example, open interest in gasoline at the lowest level it's been in 10 years, it doesn't seem to me like there's a massive spec long position in the crude oil markets that we've got a bullseye on that we're looking for to, you know, absolutely heave. It feels like rather that a lot of the speculation has left this market because maybe because they don't know which direction it's going in. The market remains tight, but the economic indicators are slowing down. So maybe that's a plan for slower gasoline demand, which the IEA continues to tell us hasn't happened much yet. So, you know, the oil market is at a really critical juncture here. If all those spreads should continue to back off below their 200-day moving averages and really just turn the trend upside down, I'll be prepared to exit a lot of my energy trades, Andreas. That's the truth.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Biden returned from his Middle East round trip, was it a week ago or so? And he basically claimed the victory, saying that the Saudi Arabians would increase the capacity to 30 million barrels a day of oil. To me, that was basically old news. You can find similar headlines from earlier this spring, for example. And I think the key word here is capacity. It's not necessarily equal to production per se. What's your take on the whole supply situation after this Biden trip? The market is still screaming for supply news, isn't it?
Well, you know, he came back from Saudi Arabia without production hikes and with COVID. So I wouldn't call that trip a massive success on any level. You know, as long as Saudi Arabia continues to raise prices to their Asian clients, as long as they manage OPEC, you know, OPEC just reported that their spare capacity was like 300,000 barrels last week, when the market is expecting them to come up with like 1.2 million spare barrels of capacity, And that just proves that story that we've been telling all along, is that OPEC doesn't have the spare capacity to really be able to clamp down on the price of crude oil, which is another reason that I kind of tend to think that it holds a dip around here. Maybe it dips to 90 or so, but I don't think that the bull market in oil is over per se. It's just maybe a time to, you know, readjust. And, you know, as long as the policy continues in the shape and form that we are in, as long as we continue to see Putin literally toy with Europe, you know, as we head into the fall here, I'm not taking my eye off of this trade. You know, natural gas has been really interesting. It just backed all the way off to about $5.50 and then rallied to $10. Here it backed off to moving average support at $8. Everybody's got it written it off for dead because of this depression that we're pricing in. If that doesn't happen, and if the recession doesn't happen, and if gas demand remains firm, we're going to see gas through $10. We're going to see ammonia prices rally, fertilizer prices rally, more pressure on the food shortage crisis. I mean, you know, this commodity trade is not one that I'm willing to walk away from quietly, if that's fair.
Absolutely, Tony. If we look at the recent price action in crude oil, it kind of seems stuck between inflationistas and recessionistas, leading to this very choppy, rangy trading. Is this recent trading range between, say, the early 90s and just below $100 a barrel tradable, as you see it, or would you just stay on the long side?
You know, for my purpose, Andreas, I've been in the trade from the long side for a long time now. I'm down to really just exposure in energy equities. You know, I sold most of my oil futures to the Russian invasion rally. For me, this is a sort of do or die moment that the market really has to show me, right? There's nothing I can do at this point except respect my risk management policies and principles. Right now, it's going to be up to the crude oil market. Gasoline is going to have to hold the 200-day moving average. The SEP OX spreads are going to have to hold their trend line supports and moving averages. And if they do, you will likely see oil back into the hundreds very quickly. You know, if this recession depression story and this economic vibe gets a lot stronger with yields remaining firm, you might see a $5 slide in the oil market. But like I said, without there being a large spec long to really shoot against, the dips in oil have been dry heaves, and I'm not really going to give up my bullish attitude or my bullish posture towards the markets on a couple of closes below the 200-day moving averages, right? Things tend to overshoot in today's markets. We got to give things a chance to play out. Unless trend really changes, I'm sticking to the bull side of this trade. It's just a really precarious moment with literally everything across the complex on critical technical support. So it could be a spill through those levels at any minute, and it could be a long grind where we hold here. And next thing you know, one data point later, and we've got a nice lift off of moving average support. So the jury's out right now, man, and I've got my hand on the buy and sell buttons simultaneously. I'm ready to trade.
I also wanted to pick your brain on risk management today, Tony. And in relation to that, I wanted to play a soundbite for you from our new Academy product at Real Vision. It's from a debate between Jamie McDonald, Roger Hurst, and James Helliwell on risk management in these uncertain markets. So let's listen to the soundbite and get back to the risk management discussion.
Sure.
So, we've talked about what drives markets. We've talked about charts and the way they, how important they are in coming up with your idea. And we've spoken about the different asset classes and like the fundamentals of each and how they're correlated. So now, what do we need to think about when it's time to put risk on, when it's time to put a trade on? So what are the stuff we need to discuss?
I mean, you're looking at things like, what's your entry point?
Yeah.
You know, where do you do it? How do you approach that first action in the market? Then do you go all in at the beginning or do you layer it? Where's your exit if you've got it wrong or you think you've got it wrong? Where are you going to start taking profits? Mm-hmm. That's the basic level. But you've also got to sort of think about how that trade fits into your portfolio. And time horizon, again, time horizon, which is how long is this trade on for? Is it based on the economics around the trade? Is it based upon your life experiences in what you need? Mm-hmm. Are you putting something on which you think is going to sit there earning you income for 10 years, or is this a 2-month trade? Mm. So there's all those things around it, which are, you know, there's a whole bunch of variables from who you are, what you want out of it, through to that specific trade and the framework you're in it.
The entire Real Investing course is available for Plus members and above in the new Academy product at the Real Vision platform. Back to you, Tony. I mean, risk management is obviously important in these choppy markets. What's your take on risk management these weeks?
You know, everything for me is an individual trade, Andreas. You know, everything on the way into and the way out of the VIEW matrix has got, you know, predefined levels where I'm happy to risk, levels where I'm going to have to get out, and I have levels in mind on targets, right? So right now, my book is kind of long only. I'm still looking for really just a market dynamic retracement bounce. I think that's going to be tradable over the next several weeks. But I'm really managing everything in its own basket, Andreas. You know, I look across my VIEW matrix every day. I tighten up the stop loss levels and the take profit levels as they change, you know, as the charts morph. And I really try to keep every line item its own risk management basket, because, you know, the minute I let, you know, something that's losing money go because I've got something else that's winning money, next thing you know, that money's gone and the money that was compensating for it is gone and I have no money left at all. And I'm very unhappy. So I find that when I manage things individually, whereas, okay, this trade is over, time to get out, I stick to that discipline and not worry about something else that maybe is working that day to offset it. Because that's the only times that I've gotten myself in serious trouble. It's you know, the volatility right now is such that, you know, you've really got to respect every major move in the markets. Today, the major move is a big move higher in interest rates. So we'll see if that carries on for the rest of the week. But those are the kinds of things that are on my mind when it comes to risk management, Andreas.
We have time for a single question from the audience in relation to this energy debate. And it's from Jim Griffin asking you about the restart of the Freeport LNG port in the US. Do you think markets will price that restart in ahead of the actual event?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. You know, we've been wrestling with that headline for about a month now. You know, natural gas prices have already had a $5 range since we've come out with that headline, and now we're somewhere in the middle. So I'm looking for the markets to, yeah, sort of accept that headline. I'd like to see that facility get back online. I think that would be bullish for natural gas prices. And that rhymes with the chart right now, Andreas. You know, we just punched to a new high, settled back into support. And, you know, that facility coming back online on time to full capacity would definitely help the natural gas market get on its feet. It's definitely being, you know, kind of dragged higher sort of mentally with the Dutch TTF spot not giving up any ground at all. It's still trading around 200 euro per megawatt hour. You know, we're still on the lookout for what Putin's doing with the TAP headlines. So this is still a trade that's still at the top of the radar screen for me.
As you know, Tony, I've made it my trademark to always conclude the daily briefing with a meme. And today I want to have a bit of fun around Nancy Pelosi's personal trading book in relation to this Taiwan visit. So I posted this on Twitter yesterday saying, get some puts on the book, honey. I'm off to Taiwan tomorrow. Let's see whether Nancy's book is the one to follow this week. Tony, thanks so much for joining us again today. It was a pleasure.
Great job, Andreas. Thank you very much.
And thank you, everyone, for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I will be back tomorrow with Peter Bukwa. See you there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.